Hello, everyone. I'm Bill Roggio. I'm a senior fellow at Foundation for Defense of Democracies and editor of FDD's Lone War Journal. This is Generation Jihad, the podcast that covers all things in what used to be known as the global war on terror, but we now call the Long War. Today is Friday. Benham, my Friday co-host, isn't available, but we have a special guest, certainly a worthy replacement. My friend and colleague at FDD and at the Long War Journal, it's Seth Franzman. Seth is an adjunct fellow at FDD, and he's the acting news editor and senior Middle East correspondent and analyst at the Jerusalem Post, as well as a contributor to the Long War Journal. He's the author of two books, Drone Wars, Pioneers, Killing Machines, Artificial Intelligence, and the Battle for the Future. He wrote that in 2021, and boy, if you look at the war in Ukraine, that's certainly worth a reread. And then his other book, After ISIS, America, Iran, and the Struggle for the Middle East. Seth wrote that in 2019. Again, very prescient. Seth, welcome to Generation Jihad. Great to have you on.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, yeah. Always a pleasure, Seth. I look forward to our conversations. So we just reached a couple of days ago, 5 days ago, we reached the 6-month mark of the Hamas and company's terror attack, terror assault. I don't even know how to describe that invasion of Israel. You recently toured the communities along the border with Gaza that were attacked. Tell us what you saw. What is it like? What's the mood amongst the people there? How are things going along the border?
So along the border, there were about 20 smaller communities. Most of them are called kibbutzim. They're communal communities. And then there's basically, you know, one or two cities that were attacked, Sderot and Ofakim. So in terms of what's happened down there in 6 months, the cities have recovered. I mean, Sderot is close to the border with Gaza, but most of the people have come back. And that was not the case a month ago or so. So things are changing very quickly. Like there's soldier checkpoints at the entrance to the city to make people feel more secure. But that place is recovered. But the other communities I went to, all the small ones, most of the residents, you know, they were evacuated basically on October 8th after a day of which they'd suffered, you know, massacres and attacks the day before. And most of those people are still evacuated. They're not really allowed to come back. There's no real infrastructure for them to return to because there's no schools operating, things like that. So they're not able to really come back. And of course, the people with the kids and such, I think they would be worried to come back considering the fact that they, you know, suffered this massacre on October 7th. There weren't no security forces. I mean, the war in Gaza is still going on. So they would be afraid to come back anyway. But the older people we met in each community, there's several people that returned. Usually they're older. Some of those people work as local security people, or they have some other job on the community, like, you know, maybe something just as simple as tending their garden or what have you. But we spoke to a bunch of these residents, and, you know, their feeling is, you know, it's not a positive one. I mean, it's a depressing situation. I mean, you're talking about communities that look like ghost towns, and you can see they were abandoned, you know, right? It's like one of those movies where all the people disappear all of a sudden, because you can just see that toys are left in the yard. Everything's exactly as it was. I mean, so in some cases, you've got burned houses and things, so you can see, you know, the bullet holes and everything exactly as it would have been. Usually those houses have graffiti on them. I guess not graffiti, but it's from first responders. If they found a body in the house, they would have left a little circle and a dot or a check mark, and then they write the date that they cleared the house to make sure there's no bodies or there's no terrorism or whatever. So you can actually see in some cases it took a week or more to clear some of these places. And the only levity or a positive, I guess, funny moments is the fact that these communities have been taken over by large numbers of animals and pets and things that were left behind. So like on one of them, there's a large number of peacocks for some reason that all escaped from a local zoo. So they're everywhere. And one of them had a bunch of parrots, and then there's dogs wandering around. And apparently during the October 7th invasion, a large number of animals came through from Gaza from the breaks in the fence, like stray dogs and things. So that was the only bit of, you know, that was kind of funny. But there is a sense that these places have been abandoned, that the government has not done enough for them, that they have not received support, that there's no real answer as to their future. And, you know, most of these communities were founded in 1949, right when the state was founded, and they were actually created to create a line of communities on the border to defend the border. So their goal historically was always defending the area. And I think it's striking the degree to which the very thing Israel was doing in 1948 to create a border has now been partially, you know, upset and evacuated. which is unprecedented in Israel's history.
Yeah, it's set them a sort of somewhat of a fan of apocalyptic movies, and that sounds exactly like what you're describing. And yeah, you see strange things, right? I've seen this sort of thing somewhat in Iraq, particularly communities that have been subject to violence from at that time Al-Qaeda in Iraq and partially abandoned. And you see some pretty strange things. It's look, if we didn't have dark humor, we'd have none when covering this. So it is interesting when you see the army of peacocks marching through and things like that. It does stick with you. So it's is there a time frame for citizens to return fully to these small communities along the border?
So I think the government continues to message, you know, change its messaging. But, you know, originally it was thought to be, you know, something like 6 months. But then it was, well, hopefully July. And July, by the way, it goes along with the school year. So no one wanted imagine all these kids on these communities. A lot of these communities are basically between 300 to 900 people. And in some of them, you have a young population. So you have, you know, 100 kids or 200 kids that have 900 people. So all those kids, of course, not only suffered, you know, the depredations and the attacks and the trauma of October 7th, but then they were taken out of school on October 8th and sent somewhere else, usually to a city. Usually what they did was take the whole community and put it in a hotel. So they're all living like in a lot or the Dead Sea or whatever. I mean, it's not ideal, but at least they're in the same place. And then the kids are going to a local school. And actually, the government did a very good job creating that environment somewhere else for them. But then the idea is, okay, it's a school. It's now they've gone through the winter term. So there's new school year. So that is okay. Well, maybe in July. But again, when we look at 6 months of war in Gaza and you still have rockets, okay, just a few, but nobody wants to deal with rockets at all. And I was in one community where we were interviewing a couple who had just come back for the day and then they left. And the guy was saying, you know, I'm not even sure the security fence that's basically a mile away has been fully repaired. And there's another side to it in terms of distributing weapons and stuff. The government, of course, probably has changed its policy a bit in terms of now reissuing all these gun licenses and giving out long rifles and stuff for people. But I was in one community. We did an interview with someone and he said the government changed its policy a few years ago and began to take away a lot of the weapons from the people in the community and put them in an armory in each community, basically a safe room or a safe house. And then the head of the security of the community would have the key to it. Now, that works if you don't have 100 terrorists entering your community quickly. So this community told me a crazy story. He said, last year or so, we upgraded all the systems into this high tech and everything's electric. And the electricity went out on October 7th when the attack happened and they couldn't get into the armory. And it's like it's just one of the most simple, crazy things of like, right, it's all high tech now and now it doesn't work. So, you know, that the little things like the fact that in a lot of these communities, you know, a few decades ago, people would go into the fields with a rifle or an Uzi, you know, around them. So, you know, changing all that and bringing back the security and making people feel secure is very important. But I've just seen how people feel that they still lack security. Like in one community, they're supposed to have soldiers guarding each of these communities now in the gate. And sometimes you show up and there's a soldier and there's people from the local security team and they question you. They want to know what you're doing. If you don't have a permission, you can't go in. But I was at one where there wasn't the soldier had gone to sleep and disappeared already. And that's the kind of October 6th mentality, which, look, anyone knows if you're guarding a place day in and day out and it's a hot desert sun, you're going to go sit in the shack or whatever. But it's the kind of thing that people see that and they're like, wait, I don't want to come back here now. So it's difficult. And I don't know. I do think a lot of the older people will come back by the summer, you know, especially men. We met a few guys who were in their 60s and they said, you know, look, I was born here. I'm going to die here. And if I die fighting terrorists or I die in 20 years, what's the difference? So those are older people, but people with kids, they mostly said, we don't think they're going to come back unless they feel very secure.
You just anticipated my next question was like, will people come back? And yeah, that like, why would, you know, if they don't feel secure, if they're not seeing that security, why would you? I mean, as a parent with children, particularly, that's an interesting. That's certainly something that bears watching. And, you know, you mentioned, right, I think one of the biggest complaints, aside from the lack of estimating Hamas's capabilities and intentions, right, that was a major intelligence failure and a failure of imagination. And we talked about this in the past, was the over-reliance on technology and, you know, on gadgets. And you just mentioned another one of them, right? You know, I wouldn't put my, you know, I realize everybody's selling firearm safes these days and, you know, digital this and biometric that. And yeah, what happens when the batteries go? What happens when the power goes? And people don't think these things through. And I think it's just a, you're right. It sounds like the Israelis in some ways are still in an October 6th mindset, despite what happened on October 7th. And we'll get to this in a little bit more detail. I want to delve into that right now, because I got a couple questions for you before when we talk about, you know, the Gaza versus Mosul op. I think that's a good opportunity to discuss that, you know, falling back into the mindset of, can we contain Hamas? And that's what it appears to be going to. But before we get to that, Seth, a couple of items in the news that we definitely had to have to tackle before that. Hamas recently said that it wants a ceasefire to find out whether the 100 plus hostages that they are holding are dead or alive. So basically, Hamas says it's lost count of what its most strategic asset in this war. And that's the hostages. I just find this very hard to believe. Have the U.S. and Israel been getting played by Hamas this entire time, which is claiming it can negotiate the release of hostages, and now saying we don't even know if we have hostages that are dead or alive? What is going on here, Seth?
Unfortunately, I do think that's the case. I mean, I think Hamas has felt throughout the conflict that they hold a lot of the cards, and I think they are probably told that by their leadership, who live abroad, who are hosted by in Doha and Qatar, and that's a U.S. you know, ally in the region, and also Hamas is backed by Iran. It's also backed by the Turkey as well, to some extent, or has support there, and Russia and China. And if you're Hamas, even though it's not a huge global movement, you know, you see the number of people supporting you, and then you look around the world and you see Israel and you say, well, look, they're losing support bit by bit. We have a lot of cards here. The hostages are part of that. And I think Hamas said, we have seen systematically after the first hostage deal in November, when they released mostly children and elderly people, which I'm sure they were told, by the way, probably by their allies abroad, that holding kids and elderly doesn't make them look that good. So, and they had at the time 250 hostages, so they figured, okay, we can release 100. I think after that, you know, Hamas can read Israel's statements, and Israel said, okay, military pressure will bring the hostages out. And so for the next month or so, there was military pressure. And then Israel began to leave northern Gaza and began to leave all sorts of places. And I think Hamas understood very quickly. They saw that Israel was under pressure for a pre-Ramadan ceasefire and stuff. And they figured, okay, we don't have to give up anything. In terms of the hostages themselves, I mean, they've done this from the beginning, claiming at different times that they can't find hostages or that quote, other groups hold them. Or at one point it was civilians were holding the hostages in some cases. I mean, in many cases, what that meant actually was kind of true. Hamas would take hostages, leave them in a civilian home and tell the people there who were probably affiliates of Hamas, you know, obviously, okay, guard these two random people. So, you know, Hamas has done this systematically. During the first deal, they were supposed to release the Bibas family and children, the two little babies. And, you know, it came to December 1st was the last day of that. And they purposely didn't release them. I mean, then they said they had been killed. But even so, I mean, so, you know, the whole thing was just macabre. So they've been playing the West and Israel and the Egyptians. And I mean, obviously, it's clear that had the West put more pressure on them immediately and said, you have to release all these people, otherwise we'll do everything possible to dismantle you, you know, they would have released more of them. But they feel the wind in their sails. And again, they can read the media just like we can. And they understand that, you know, Israel's leaving parts of Gaza, Israel's changing its tactics, Israel's, you know, being, quote, less intense warfare, whatever. So that's, and they see that and they figure they can just hold on.
You're 100% right. Look, and I'll just say this. Hamas is holding the cards because the United States and Israel is letting them hold the cards. That's an absolute mistake. And you're right. They can read the press. Western officials think that leaking information and intentions and being conciliatory is messaging to Hamas to get them to concede. And what they don't understand, and they should have understood this after 20 years of plus of war in Iraq and Afghanistan and elsewhere, that our enemies read it a different way. They read that as weakness, not as strength or conciliatory. And it's an absolute mistake. And I would like to say I'm shocked that this still happens, but nothing shocks me at this point after covering this war for two decades. So Seth, there's been reports that the Iran is going to respond within the next 24 to 48 hours for Israel killing an IRGC general, his deputy, and several other key IRGC commanders or operatives, officers, however you want to describe them, in an attack either in or near the consulate, the Iranian consulate in Damascus. What, I want to caveat this by saying it's a Friday about 10 a.m. April 12th. So if this episode, if something happens between the time this is published and us making this, the talking about this, understand where we're coming from here. What is the, do the Israelis, are they on a war footing here? What do we, if the Iran, what do you think an Iranian response would look like? And what do you think an Israeli response to that would look like? I guess it all matters. It depends on what the Iranian response is, right?
Right. So, you know, I think we've seen historically, you know, Iran is willing sometimes to retaliate from their own soil for things like this. So when the United States killed, IRGC Quds Force head Qasem Soleimani and also the head of Kataib Hezbollah, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, in January of 2020, you know, the Iranians did respond. They fired, 20 or more ballistic missiles at al-Assad base. That could have been a deadly attack. It turned out it wasn't, but people got traumatic brain injuries. But you know, those missiles could have had the bad luck of hitting like a barracks or something and killing a bunch of people. But you know, so Iran is willing to retaliate sometimes. Iran is also willing to attack from its own soil. In other cases, they attacked Upcake in Saudi Arabia in 2019. They used drones and missiles. You know, that's one option they have. But you know, they know from what we've seen, the messaging from the United States and Israel has been very clear on this, which is that if they do something big like that, you know, Israel would have a right then to retaliate against Iran itself. And Israel generally doesn't, you know, has never publicly certainly attacked Iranian soil. I mean, the Iranians view the attack in Damascus, of course, and the consulate as their soil, but in terms of inside Iran. So, you know, I think there's a high stakes game going on here in terms of brinksmanship and things. The other Iranian option, which Iran has done many times in the past, is that they use proxies, right? They use Iraqi-based militias to fly. They've done this already. They've flown drones from Iraq to Eilat in southern Israel, which is a long way. They've used the Houthis in Yemen to attack Eilat and attack ships. They've used Hezbollah to carry out thousands of attacks since October 7th. And they've attacked Israel from Syria. So, you know, for them, the easy route is to put a bunch, you know, they could, by the way, you know, 2018, 2019, reports said they had moved ballistic missiles into Anbar province in Iraq, which is the same place that, you know, Saddam Hussein used put Scuds to attack Israel. So, you know, that would be the easy route, was to be to move some missiles into Iraq, claim that an Iraqi militia fired them, and in fact, it's IRGC guys doing it, right? And do some sort of symbolic thing where they claim they targeted, you know, a base or infrastructure in Israel. I mean, they've been kind of putting out propaganda about attacking airports and things. So, you know, and then the Iranians would assume that the missiles would be intercepted. So then they can say, okay, no harm, no foul. No one died. We fired stuff. We got revenge, but nothing happened. I mean, and then Israel shouldn't attack us, you know. And there will be Iranian messaging probably via, you know, some third party to get to say to Israel, okay, you see, we did something, but we didn't do much. Let's not go crazy. I mean, so that would be the typical what the Iranians usually do. But and we've seen reports that they could, you know, use dozens of drones or something against Israel. So we'll see. It's a complicated time. It's one of the first times that the messaging from Iran has ratcheted up to the point where everyone is saying that they expect the attack, as opposed to the past, where the Iranian IRGC commander would say, you know, we're going to destroy Israel, and, you know, destroy it. But okay, but when? Well, you know, eventually. So that's where we are. I don't know. I mean, everyone here in Israel is kind of expecting something, but no one's panicking. I mean, the government messaging has generally been pretty low level in terms of what to do. They've said, don't change any your routine much. The schools have put out some weird statement in some cases telling people to take home homework for the extra few days in case something happens. But I think the spokesman for the IDF had put out a funny statement saying, you don't need to stockpile generators and food. And people would say, I never thought to stockpile generators.
That's a great idea.
Now I should go get them. So, you know, that's where we are. I would say the foreign governments seem to be taking this more seriously than the Israel, because Israel wants to downplay it a bit.
Yeah. And, you know, look, I'm with you, Seth. One of the things I've been saying since this happened is like, Iran is attacking Israel daily. It's doing it via its proxies, right? Hezbollah on the border, daily attacks. Hamas firing rockets into Gaza, and then, of course, its attack on October 7th of last year. The Houthis have been firing drones and ballistic cruise missiles at the at southern Israel. So this has happened, right? You know, I think another like possibility is Iran hits at you know, an Israeli consulate or an Israeli embassy, or tries to assassinate maybe a high profile Israeli citizen or government official overseas. That's also another possibility in there. Yeah, but I'm with you. I don't think that Iran needs to launch something from Iranian soil in order to make this threat good. I do think that there's, you know, I feel like, you know, since this attack happened, that people have been saying Iran's going to attack Israel in the next 24 to 48 hours. And they've been saying that for the last week, but that's just, maybe that's me. Maybe I'm perceiving that wrong, but it does seem to be a lot more concern about this here in the United States or in Europe than there does in Iran, but maybe that's a mistake as well. Right. Who knows? But all right, let's turn to, you had a, this is the real reason I wanted to get you on, not that I'd want to discuss these other things, but you had a couple of insightful tweets over the last week. And one of them, was talking about comparing the Israeli operation in Gaza versus the Iraqi and coalition operation, which, by the way, included the Iranians in Mosul. And I'm going to quote from your tweet from a couple days ago. And here we go. Quote, I remember when the war in Gaza began, I got a number of requests to write articles comparing the challenges of fighting Hamas in Gaza to fighting ISIS in Mosul, since I had covered both wars. I wrote a bunch of articles. Today, I'm dismayed, and here's why. And then you go into depth as to why these wars were not the same. And before we get into that, I'll just give you a little background here. I was asked to do the same. And my response to people who asked me about this was, you won't like my answer because it won't be the answer that you want, that these wars will be very similar. You know, I was also asked to write articles to compare, you know, ISIS and Hamas is why they're the exact same thing. I believe Netanyahu had made that statement, and that seemed to like resonate, or, you know, within a lot of circles. And I also refused to write those articles. I felt that was a sophomoric comparison at best. But with respect to the Gaza versus Mosul, the reasons I had for why I, at the time, I said the operations wouldn't be the same. First of all, not a single country, no one was going to protest the Iraqis stamping out ISIS, right? ISIS is hated by everyone, and no one's going to side with ISIS. Another one, no one really cares when Arabs kill. Let's just be honest. No one cares when Arabs kill Arabs. And if the Syrian civil war didn't teach us that, then, you know, you just weren't paying attention. They do care when Israelis kill Palestinians. That is something that people care about a lot. Time was never on Israel's side, and Israel's hands were always going to be handcuffed with this war. We see that today with aid flowing in and all the condemnations and the demands for Israel to have a ceasefire. But, you know, you've certainly had the benefit of hindsight of observing this closely over the last 6 months. And, you know, so a lot of this is what you mentioned in your tweet is very tactical or on the battlefield level. So tell us what has changed your mind here, because to me, I read this and just nodded my head the whole way.
Right. So what's interesting is, I mean, there's a time frame that's similar. In 2016, October, the Iraqis launched the offensive against Mosul. They had to clear out a bunch of little villages and areas. I mean, Mosul's a big city. I mean, it used to have a few million residents, and it's on two sides of a river. It's not easy to take it, actually. And also, again, ISIS controlled these little villages and a big belt around it. So the Iraqis had a lot of work to do. They had to cut the city off, first of all, in a huge encircling maneuver. They had Kurdish forces coming in from one side and the Iraqi federal forces coming in from the other side. And then the Kurds were going to stop at some point, and then the Iraqis would go into Mosul. And the plan was it would be Iraqi army and paramilitary police, not the Iranian-backed Shia militias, because of the sensitivity. So it was a complicated operation involving tens of thousands of men. The Israelis also, you know, had the same issue. They had this area of Gaza, which is, Gaza City is big. It's also about 2 million people in Gaza. So similar size of populations, actually. Gaza has a bunch of other things in it, a bunch of towns and villages and other cities like Khan Yunis and Rafah. So in terms of the area that had to be taken, you know, there were similar complexities. Hamas had tunnels, a lot more tunnels than ISIS did, but they were both embedded in a civilian population. Hamas estimated about, I think the estimate is about 30,000 fighters, and ISIS had a lot less, probably. you know, 5 or 10 or a bit more, something like that. Not as many. But again, the Iraqi army that was arrayed against ISIS was much weaker than the Israeli army on paper. It had on paper divisions and battalions and things, but in fact, it didn't have that many tanks. It didn't have much of an air force, really. It was supported by the coalition air force, but the coalition was very reticent to use the air force inside the city. They didn't want to have civilian casualties, and also the coalition didn't have an endless number of air assets they were going to use. So it was pretty complicated. And you know, what I said when I was asked to write these articles was the challenges are similar. The campaign could be run similarly. The way the Iraqis did it was they spent, you know, a month or two trying to get into Mosul. They conquered the eastern part of the city on the eastern bank of the river there, Tigris, I guess it is. So it took them months to do that, and they lost a lot of people. The Iraqi army, they lost lots of Humvees to ambushes and things. But what they did, which was smart, was they got all the civilians out first. Then they built IDP camps for them. And what they did was, and I saw this in person because I was on the line there when the civilians were coming through. Civilians would come out in you know, trucks or different ways, and they'd be lined up and they'd be searched. The men on one side, women on the other, whatever, and they'd be searched. And they would make sure that these people aren't carrying weapons. And then I guess there was apparently, you know, some intel people somewhere that were trying to see if any of them are actually ISIS guys or affiliates or whatever. So they were very good at filtrating them out, putting them in a camp somewhere and dealing with that. And then the city was basically cleared of civilians. It took some time. There were some civilians there when I got there. I was in Mosul when it began in October. I came back in March, April of the next year, 2017. So I saw the end of the battle in the old city, kind of. There were some civilians, but most of them were gone. So the difference with Israel was that Israel decided they didn't want to deal with IDP camps or run civilian affairs at all. So the whole idea was get the civilians to leave Gaza City and go south to Rafah, next to the Egyptian border. And Israel then successfully cleared Gaza City by November, December. So a similar time frame, in fact, if you look at what the Iraqis had done. So the opening moves were kind of similar, but then you start to see where the Israeli experience kind of breaks down and changes, which is that the Iraqis went across the river and then went into the other part of Mosul, the western side, in, let's say, February, March, April, May, and they ended in June, basically. So it took them like 4 months to go street by street. It was very difficult fighting, very slow, very difficult, using paramilitary police, federal police, which are not really the kind of people you'd actually maybe want to do that kind of work. But the Iraqis didn't have an endless number of troops, so they had to use someone. Israel, by contrast, you know, I guess it also did have an issue of after 100 days of fighting, you had to rotate units in and out. But what Israel did, which was a strange tactic, and I think it's probably not going to prove to be successful, is that Israel basically cleared northern Gaza City and then took all the troops out and then decided, okay, now we'll go into the southern part, Khan Yunis. And then just this last week, they took all the troops out of Khan Yunis. And basically, the evidence is that Hamas returned all these areas basically overnight. In the north, what happened was Hamas returned to Shifa Hospital, and literally, I think almost 1,000 Hamas members moved there. And Israel then went back in and arrested them all. And Israel sold that as a great success, saying, you see, all these Hamas guys, they can't go in the tunnels anymore because we destroyed the tunnels. So now they have to run around on the surface of the earth. And what we do is we wait for them to show up, and then we use our intel assets and drones and all this stuff to kind of track where they all went. And then we go in and raid. And Israel's been doing a number of these raids all throughout Gaza City now. Shati Camp, Zeytun, Shifa. They just went into Nusayrat yesterday and Shujaya. But, you know, small raids designed to take out a few people and mow the grass. But the Iraqis never did that kind of thing. I mean, the Iraqis, once the Iraqis took a neighborhood, they took it. And that was it. And you take it. And then what the Iraqis would do eventually was let some civilians come back bit by bit, very slowly, and checking everyone, double checking, triple checking. And look, the Iraqi army probably abused people, or let's say, for instance, in the camps, I think they unleashed some of these militias to abuse people. And those militias are not nice people. And, you know, both Israel and the coalition made mistakes in terms of killing civilians. The coalition aircraft killed, I think, 100 or 200 civilians in Jadida in Western Mosul. So the same kind of mistakes were made in terms of the criticism of the campaign. But the end result after 6 months is that after 6 months of the Mosul op, the Iraqis had successfully cleared and held an area. And Israel has decided that, no, it doesn't want to hold these areas. It doesn't want to govern them. I mean, and you can say that's a good decision. Israel doesn't have a great track record of governing. I mean, the whole point of the Oslo peace process is Israel won't govern things. But then you should find someone else to govern, and not just Hamas plainclothes policemen.
Is there someone else to govern? Seth?
Well, that's a difficult question. Look, there's a Palestinian Authority, which is supposed to be based, not only backed by the West, which is supposed to be the authority, i.e. a state in the making. I think some countries actually recognize Palestine, so therefore it is the state. The Palestinian Authority security forces have been trained by the United States for like a decade and a half now. And also the Palestinian police have been trained by the UPOL COPS organization, which is a bunch of Western countries. So ostensibly, there is a government that is backed by the West that in theory, you'd think that the West would say, great, let's put them in charge of Gaza. They're supposed to be in charge. In fact, I think legally somehow they actually are somehow in charge because the salaries of some of the employees of the Palestinian government are paid somehow in Gaza. So somehow they're supposed to be there. It's unclear why no one decided to put them there. Israel's governing coalition, which is made up of a whole bunch of parties, some of whom are, you know, extreme right and very, very much against the Palestinian Authority, they view the Palestinian Authority as kind of an existential threat because they view the idea of a Palestinian state as an existential threat. So this creates, you know, a catch-22, which is the army is sent in to do a job. Armies are not good at governing people. So you have to therefore have a civilian authority, just like America did in Iraq in 2003 or four, right? They had this coalition provisional authority thing. Those things don't always work well, but there was never a strategy or a political aspect of this war. There's no Clausewitzian thing going on here. There's just the army. So again, that's not really great in terms of the strategy of what comes next. And by the way, we've seen that the Americans run into this problem as well in places like Syria, where the quote buy with and through strategy of, you know, you do just military stuff and there's no political angle. You have some group that you work with, that there's your partner forces, but there's no political end goal. You just kind of, you do the military work and then it's like, okay, that's it. So, and Israel's running into this. And I would say from my personal point of view, I would think the Palestinian Authority would be the best people to run Gaza, or maybe a reformed version of it. Or as some people have said, well, let's have clans and families run it. Historically, they say that the clans in Gaza, when they did run parts of Gaza, let's say in the 80s or 90s, when it was a bit chaotic, the clans used to fight each other all the time. And I've talked to Israelis who served there, older guys that served in Khan Yunis like in the 80s. And they said, yeah, every night they'd bring us dead bodies from clan warfare. And because we were the authorities at the time, the Israelis, we had to take the bodies out of the police station and register them and then hand them back because that was the whole rigmarole that went on. And you say, yeah, well, maybe the clans are not the ideal people, but there should be a governing structure supported by the West and not Hamas, I would think.
So, Seth, that's really interesting what you mentioned with the clans. If you would think that the Israelis might want to go that way if they're fighting each other, that's probably less likely they'd be being able to organize to fight the Israelis. Not ideal, certainly, but what you had just described in your comments here is what is commonly referred to as whack-a-mole. Basically, these Israelis have cleared areas, but they refuse to hold them. Should we be shocked when the same political and military leaders that gave Israel October 7th, and I would argue probably a decade and a half plus of just failed policies, that they've given us a failed strategy in Gaza today?
I mean, yeah, the absence of a strategy probably leads to a failed strategy. So they have an absence of a strategy. I can understand from the Israeli military's perspective, the IDF, they wanted for since Oslo to get out of the civilian affairs game. And that makes sense for a military because militaries generally are just not good at running civilian affairs, usually generally not that great, or certainly over a long period of time. Maybe they can do it for a short period, but eventually the military gets sucked into running that and stops being a military. So I think, you know, I can understand from the Israel Defense Forces saying, we don't want the hot potato. And then I can understand what happens at the political echelon is, and they say, well, we don't want it either because we don't want to work with the Palestinian Authority or they won't work with us. I mean, there's another side of this. Let's remember that the other side of it is Hamas has spent 20 years indoctrinating and destroying Gaza and, you know, running it as a mafia, cartel, narco, terror state. Well, I don't know about narcotics, but the rest of it, cartel, terror state. So Hamas, you know, if you're a poor Gazan, and most of Gaza's population, by the way, is under the age of 20, I think. So if you're a 20-year-old and your whole life is under Hamas, you know, you'd be dead terrified of this mafia organization that's going to come back. So you don't want to, quote unquote, collaborate with either the Israelis or the PA or anyone else. So there is another side to it, which is that there isn't an easy strategy for Israel either. But what I've heard from some people in Israel, I think the defense minister has talked about it, and some people are saying, let's try to create a few bubbles in Gaza, like kind of like a few neighborhoods, and try to create local authorities that govern that neighborhood, and then let's say have Israeli checkpoints on the outside of it, but let a local authority run it that isn't Hamas. I think that wasn't a bad idea. Like, can there be some sort of interim solution that begins to show the local people, oh, you know what? I don't have to live under Hamas. I can be run by some other thing. It doesn't work on a big scale because I would imagine how, because Israel does it. Again, Israel doesn't have the tools, the ability to run Gaza City. But I would think that that could have been done. Unfortunately, I think there was just no attempt to do it. And I do think there's been a kind of, I don't know if it's been sabotaged or whatever, but when we look at Israel's political debates about the day after, there's, when it gets to the political angle, there's always an internal fight and it ends up being sabotaged, which is to say, the defense ministry was not allowed to basically go into Gaza and run things the way they wanted. The political echelon said, well, wait, hold your horses. We don't really like that. Let us come up with a day after plan. And by the way, the whole Rafah operation has been mismanaged like that as well, because you remember probably that Israel was saying, you know, we want to go into Rafah. The military was probably saying that at some point, and the defense ministry. And then the political echelons took over that debate and said, okay, we are going to go into Rafah. And then it became this whole, again, a whole weird hot potato. So unfortunately, I just think you look at, it's difficult to run a war where there isn't a strategy, where the coalition government doesn't always agree with itself, where the war cabinet, quote unquote, that runs the war has differing personalities who don't get along with each other. Almost, I just think all those things, the elements, I remember when the U.S. went into Iraq in 1990-91, the whole concept of the Powell Doctrine of like, let's learn from Vietnam and do the opposite of like clear goals and a quick campaign and then immediately leave so we don't get stuck here. The whole elements of what apparently supposedly made that doctrine successful was to have all of the horses, everything traveling in the same direction, you know, kind of Clausewitzian concept. And I think the whole Bush senior administration, at least, seemed to all be on the same wavelength in that. So when you don't run a war like that, then I think you run into the kind of issues that are being faced in Gaza.
Yeah, the Bush administration always had the luxury of not having to occupy Iraq in the first Gulf War, right? Because it's not on its border. That's the real problem that the Israelis, you know, having a proto-terror state on its border is always going to be a problem. This is why they need to be thinking about these solutions and coming up with a solution. But it sounds like, you know, what you described, the political, there's just no consensus that could be made to plan for the day after. You know, it's interesting. You had an excellent set of tweet on why, you know, Hamas is like a cartel or the mafia, as you explained. And, you know, Seth, I used to get asked this question a lot, like, oh, I want to learn more about Al-Qaeda and how it operates. What should I read? And the book I always recommended was Mark Bowden's Killing Pablo. And we get the weird, I don't understand. That's a, you know, narco-terrorist group. And I'm like, this is how these groups ingratiate themselves, embed themselves in local populations and exploit weak governments and use violence and whatnot. So, yeah, I thought that was very insightful comment from you. And I completely agree. We see that with, even to this day, you know, the Israelis want to tell us they've defeated Hamas and there's only four battalions left. And yet I'm watching aid convoys being, you know, guys with rifles, clearly members of Hamas, sitting on top of aid convoys, on top of the trucks, escorting them through. You know, that's not what a defeated enemy looks like. Hamas is, its ability to persist. This is something the Israelis have to deal with, or if they don't, they're going to lose this war. And I just don't see a comprehensive political strategy paired with a reasonable military strategy to clear but not hold, to play, to do whack-a-mole. It doesn't work against groups like these.
No, I agree. I mean, it's definitely a big problem. I mean, again, the whole issue of the battalions always mystified me, because
yeah,
Hamas was never supposed to be allowed to become such a dangerous terrorist group that it would have battalions that you had to defeat. I mean, it was supposed to remain a crappy terrorist group. And the fact that it became so powerful that we now hear, well, it's kind of impossible to defeat, or it will take 20 years or something. You say, well, why would you allow a terrorist group that takes 20 years or 10 years to defeat to grow up on your border and become exponentially more powerful? And then on October 6th, there's no one sitting, you know, in the high command saying, well, hold on a minute, isn't this organization now so powerful that it has 30,000 trained fighters and 24 battalions? We better not leave 300 combat soldiers on the border against this. I mean, because it doesn't make sense, because either you believe it was deterred and it's kind of weak, or it has 24 battalions and therefore it looks like a pretty tough organization. My sense of the Hamas battalions is, you know, again, it's easy to say we defeated this battalion. But if in fact what happened was the Hamas members themselves dispersed the unit, I think they did. I think they just dispersed most of them and said, okay, guys, take off your uniforms, go to ground, just wait. The Israelis will leave in a few months. And that's what they, and that, and Hamas would say that's what they've done before. So my sense is that's why the Shifa story is interesting. Hamas reconstituted itself basically overnight and had 1,000 people show up at a hospital to start running things again. You don't gather 1,000 guys in a room, senior and young junior terrorists, like this quickly without a pretty good extensive network that was just ready to be keyed back in. And you say, okay, guys, you got the go code. Let's start it. Let's start work again. So clearly those units had just gone to ground. And I get the sense that when we hear about, you know, these units being destroyed, some of them are units on paper a bit. And I don't, it doesn't take away from the IDF accomplishments. They have eliminated terrorists. They have destroyed tunnels. They have destroyed all sorts of things. But if your goal is just to eliminate terrorists and you don't account for the fact that there will be more of them, I mean, recruited or whatever, then it's not clear where the end is. If your goal is to tear it up by the roots, like a cartel, like, as you said, killing Pablo, how did they get rid of Pablo Escobar? They didn't just kill a few Pablo's gunmen or whatever. I'm sure he had his version of battalions as well. Like, what do they used to call them? The, you know, they had some word for it as well. It doesn't help to get rid of those people. I mean, you have to go after the organization and hunt them down and rip it up by the roots, which is what they did. And they killed him.
Yeah, they went after the money. They went after his key lieutenants. They turned them. They built organizations, some paramilitary that did some pretty terrible things to go after family. But like, you know, it's an ugly war. It's not something that it's just, I'll arrest some guys. I'll do. This is what makes the Biden administration's insistence that, oh, well, we could just conduct, the Israelis can just conduct targeted raids against Hamas. It's got tens of thousands of fighters. Clearly, the Israelis claim they've killed 13,000. If that's true, and yet Hamas still persists, it's still able to organize 1,000 fighters at the El Shifa hospital. Again, what, you know, you laid that out perfectly. So what does that tell us about Hamas? And these are the things that really concern me when the Israelis, I just don't feel, between their lack of real strategy and the Western pressure, the turn of the United States against Israel, which I think is more than just domestic politics. I think there's an element of the, you know, the far left of the Democratic Party has really taken hold, this dislike of Israel and this support for Hamas. They'll say it's support for the Palestinians, but I can't read it any other way. And I think it's a real danger for the Israelis. One of my biggest, and I know we talked about this in the past, Seth, is that I really felt they made a mistake, the Israelis not taking Rafah first, not cutting off those tunnels, and then doing a hammer and anvil type strategy. And I know people will argue, well, we had to stop those rockets from coming from northern Gaza. Yes, you did. And maybe the Israelis could have organized to launch operations in both the north and south simultaneously. Or maybe you could have endured a couple of weeks of rocket attacks, but shutting off that border and closing that down. And, you know, look, the reality is in week one, if the Israelis would have went into Rafah first, no one was going to complain about it. There was still enough sympathy for the Israelis after what they endured on October 7th. But if you're 6 months in, that clock's been ticking. It's way too long for the Israelis. And I'm concerned that the Israelis may not get an opportunity to go into Rafah. What do you think? Is that a possibility?
I think it is. I mean, I think it was never a good idea to make Rafah into a totem of the war. I mean, first of all, from a tactical, strategic, military perspective, yes, it should have been taken immediately to cut off.
It was the only border that the Israelis couldn't control. They controlled the sea and they controlled the eastern border and the northern border, but they couldn't control that southern border with Egypt. So that's the one you had to take out. That's where the tunnels are, where that can allow the leaders and fighters to flow back and forth, and where weapons and explosives can keep coming through those tunnels. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off there.
No, 100%. I mean, it made sense. I'm sure that there was a conversation about it. Part of what happened probably was, A, Israel's, you know, militaries like to wage the same campaigns they've done before in the past. Like, you know, I mean, so the plans that were put in place were the same ones as 2009, basically, in terms of a staged movement across Gaza, where you slowly move by stage by piece by piece. The Netzarim Corps corridor that they took, which is south of Gaza City, to cut it off Gaza City. That's a corridor, by the way, that they used to run in the 80s and 90s. Every time there were disturbances, that was the place that they'd man those checkpoints and be able to divide the strip in two. So, you know, old habits die hard. Yeah. I mean, of course, there was a strategy to go into Rafah in the past as well, the Philadelphia route and stuff. But I think that, you know, there was probably messaging out there, well, let's not put the pressure on Hamas too much because we want to get the hostages out. The Egyptians are asking us not to go in. Let's do what we've done before, which is go into Gaza City and destroy them there. And then we can negotiate with Hamas over what happens in southern Gaza. And in retrospect, that didn't turn out well. And I think that the other issue is once it became a political discussion whether to go into Rafah, then everything got tied up with that, where we had this back and forth you hear between Israel and the United States. Once the U.S. saying you're not allowed to go in. I mean, it would be bizarre if in the Gulf War of 2003, right, the U.S. had gotten to Baghdad, like the outskirts, and then there was a political discussion with the Europeans about whether the U.S. should go into Baghdad, and the Europeans were like, well, probably you shouldn't. I mean, you'd be like, this is insane. You can't run a war like this. I mean, I don't know. You know, there were lots of mistakes in Vietnam. I don't know if there was ever that kind of level of like, well, we're not going to go into this.
There was. We can't go across the border into North Vietnam.
Right.
That was a big thing for a long time.
You can't bomb the Ho Chi Minh Trail.
Exactly.
Ah, yeah, that's right. There was this whole crazy thing where
the
Nixon administration would do linebacker one or two or whatever. And there was this whole crazy thing of, well, you can bomb here, but not here. And it's like, yeah, you guys, you can't run a war like this. It's insane.
This is no way to run a war.
Right. So, again, the Rafah thing, again, in the first months of the war, you could say, like, listen, there was a tactical discussion, strategic, because it wasn't clear. But then once it became a political back and forth with the U.S. about Rafah, that was not a good sign in terms of what would come next. And the fact that now it's been made in Israel into this political thing where Netanyahu said, okay, we're going to go in. And then his coalition members were like, we're going to leave the coalition unless you tell us when. And he said, well, I have a date. And then the U.S. said, we never heard about a date. And then the defense minister in Israel said, we didn't hear about a date either. It's like, This is just totally mad. So it's not good that it became a totem of the war. There's another practical side to it, which, again, the comparison with Mosul, it was not good in retrospect to move all the civilians to Rafah, because then it makes it impossible to go in there.
So yeah, exactly.
Had the civilians been allowed to have an IDP camp somewhere in the north, you know, run by international organizations or whatever, even though they're not ideal, but they're better than nothing, I guess, then you wouldn't have a million people there. It was always easier to say, listen, send them south. As you just said, where does all the aid come from? It comes through Rafah. Hamas controls it. So that, by the way, helped Hamas exponentially by giving them 100% control over all this aid and all their gunmen that run the trucks. Now Israel's shifting gears a bit, by the way. They're moving in a lot more aid to the north with a new crossing. And I assume the defense ministry is thinking, okay, let us open up a new crossing for the aid. That will relieve the pressure on Rafah. The people will come back to the north, and then we'll get a chance to do the operation we'd like to do. But there will be severe international pressure. Although, as Israel, I think, as Netanyahu has said, you know, the whole world cannot stop us from going into Rafah, which is big words and big talk. But okay, well, let's see. And the rumor is maybe in May or June. I don't know. We'll see. I mean, you know, we just don't know.
Yeah, that clock. I think that clock has run out on the Israelis. I mean, they may well do it. But it's going to come with a serious price from the international community. As soon as questions began being raised about the Gaza operation, the Israelis should have launched it. They should have been prepared for this. One of the things that drives me crazy with following what's happening with Israel and the Palestinians is the Israelis try to play by the international rules that they never can. You know, I always say I don't play games that I won't win. So why even try? Like, why are the Israelis trying to play a game that they know they can't win by trying to provide aid into Gaza? It's, you know, would we have provided aid to the Islamic State as we were fighting them? It just makes absolutely no sense. Should we be insistent on airdropping aid into Kabul as we were invading Afghanistan post 9/11? These are the things that absolutely should we have been concerned with. German citizens in Berlin and Dresden while we were bombing them. It made, you know, could you imagine an argument here in the United States during World War II? Well, we have to be thinking about the German citizens because not all Germans are Nazis and they didn't really have a choice. It's, you know, at some point you just have to draw lines. And if you want to win, you have to fight wars. You just can't be overly concerned. The Israelis have put themselves in a situation where they can't win, and they keep trying to play that game. Is that what you see, Seth?
I think there's a gist. Yeah, I mean, in a way, look, the problem with Gaza is Israel is addicted to dealing with Gaza. Israel, it was, as we all know, probably the history, it was conquered in 67 by Israel from the Egyptians. Prior to that, the Egyptians had used Gaza as a base to have Fedayeen terrorist attacks in the 50s against Israel. Then that kind of calmed down in the 60s and there was a war. And then, you know, very quickly in the 70s, there was terrorism from Gaza directed to Israel, and Israel went in heavy and destroyed all the terrorist networks there. In those days, you know, parts of those Arab areas in Gaza would have been self-governing or whatever. And then in the 80s, you have the second, by the way, the Intifada, the first Intifada started in Gaza. Right. It's not always remembered. It's Gaza that did it. I mean, it's amazing that the Palestinian National Movement, people generally view it as somehow connected to the West Bank, because the West Bank gave birth to lots more of the intellectuals and stuff from that movement, whereas Gaza has given birth to Hamas. But the fact is, most of a lot of Palestinian history is tied up with things that happened in Gaza, which is the first Intifada, the terror attacks in the 50s. And then, as you know, even in the second Intifada, the killing of Mohammed Al-Dura, that very famous video that happened that, you know, galvanized a lot of emotions, it happened in Gaza. The disengagement that Israel did, which was a total change of policy, happened in Gaza. October 7th happened in Gaza. I mean, so Israel has a long, bloody, weird, terrible history, but it's also a bit of an addiction to Gaza, which is to say, even when Israel tried to leave, you know, they kept supplying things like fuel, like electricity, like, by the way, Israeli hospitals, you know, were treating many people from Gaza, you know, and there was a whole thing there where it was never willing to be unconnected with it. And also, there's another weird side of this, which is that even when Israel left, many international groups and community and organizations and human rights groups, quote unquote, have defined Gaza as occupied and continuing to be occupied. So Israel was not even allowed to leave when it wanted to leave. And I would say that, you know, we have to remember that that's part of the equation here, which is that from an international law perspective, even though I'm not a big fan or believer in it, but many people are and states are, Israel is responsible for Gaza and Israel is the governing authority, oddly enough. So I would say that when you start to look at these kind of things and you say, well, you know, when we fought Nazi Germany or what have you, we wouldn't have, you know, we were not airdropping aid into Berlin. Of course not. But again, because that was considered just totally an enemy country, the difference, I guess, I don't know where you'd find it in U.S. history or something, but the Iraqi comparison with Mosul makes more sense because Mosul is clearly part of Iraq. So when ISIS ran it as a, you know, a miniature terrorist state. But from the Iraqi point of view, the people in Mosul were hostages of ISIS and they're Iraqi citizens. So, you know, Iraq didn't airdrop aid because it doesn't have any capabilities like that. But Iraq did supply electricity and things. I think there was probably, I don't know exactly how it worked, but I think there was aid and stuff that went back and forth. So it's not a simple story. I mean, I agree that you cannot allow a terrorist group to run all the aid going in. And the fact is, most international organizations that work in Gaza partner with Hamas. And, you know, how can you explain that there were 1,000 terrorists in Shifa Hospital and not one doctor or any of these international organizations that have connections with all these health authorities? You don't have one guy that says, man, there's 1,000 terrorists in there.
Not even an anonymous complaint, right?
No, it's crazy.
I can understand they fear for their lives. I could get that. Yes. But,
yeah. No, there's a cult of omerta. I guarantee you, if some journalists really wouldn't want to go deep into this, they'd find out that every time an international organization sends medical staff there, they are specifically told, do not ever mention that who actually runs everything there, which is Hamas. We don't even mention Hamas. Many times, by the way, when you see reports from Gaza by organizations or statements, sometimes the word Hamas is not even mentioned.
Right.
There was an op-ed by the president of Egypt and Jordan and the president of France recently that ran in a few papers. I don't think the opinion piece by them, which calls for a ceasefire and things and also calls for hostages and I'm pretty sure it doesn't even mention the word Hamas. And you're like, how can you talk about a war and a ceasefire and things and just not mention the one party of the war? And again, that's where you start to ask yourself about the ISIS war, about your comparison with Nazi Germany and things. We sure as heck didn't ever, you know, write an article about that or have international organizations that just pretended ISIS or the Nazis just didn't exist. And that's the uphill battle that Israel faces. I mean, the amount of things that are, the amount of challenges arrayed against Israel, regardless of Israel's own problematic policies of how it's waged the war, the amount of things that Herculean challenges in terms of the international community, international organizations, and groups that are addicted to Hamas or partner with it or pay it money or have done these aid trucks where the aid workers literally wait with the truck until the gunmen arrive, and he is like their partner, and you're like, how can you run aid like this? Why is a plainclothes gunman your friend? This is nuts.
Yeah, this is nuts. That's pretty much it. You know, Israel just can't seem to quit Gaza as much as it wants to. And that is the real tragedy of all this. The Israelis left Gaza in, what was it, 2005, 2006? I always get the date wrong. And here we are today because the people of Gaza, because Hamas can't just run its state. It seeks the destruction of Israel. It's in its charter. And that's the whole reason why this war persists, not because the Israelis want to continue to occupy Gaza. If they did, they wouldn't be leaving Gaza City. They wouldn't be leaving Khan Yunis. And that's the reality of it. Any parting thoughts, Seth, before we go?
Well, I think we're in a new phase now in Gaza. The reduction of forces, you know, is important. It means Israel rethinking what comes next. The opening of a lot more crossings and aid into Gaza's, you know, means people are thinking about what comes next. There's a lot of things in motion right now that will determine the next 6 months and the next and what happens in this war. I'm pessimistic and cynical, but nevertheless, I mean, it is plausible that some sort of thing could come out of this. I mean, an Incheon-like maneuver, you know, or something where suddenly, you know, two Israeli divisions show up in Rafah and there's it's all over. You never know. But so far we have a wait and see approach.
Yeah, I'm with you. I hate being the pessimist, but these wars have given me no reason to be optimistic. And the amount of pressure being leveraged against Israel is just absolutely stunning. I just didn't expect this from the U.S. I mean, actually, I did expect it. I just had hoped not to see it from the Biden administration. If the U.S. had remained steadfast, I think the Israelis could have been in a better, had more room to maneuver. But the Biden administration's turn against Israel is quite worrying. If you're an Israeli citizen or a supporter of Israel, you have to be very worried about what is next. But Seth, thank you so much for joining us on today's episode of Generation Jihad. We've got to get you back on soon for your excellent insights. And thanks everyone for listening to today's episode of Generation Jihad. Just a reminder, you can listen to us on YouTube, Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you listen to podcasts. Please subscribe to Generation Jihad and leave us a review, preferably a positive one, but only if we earned it. Thanks again, and we'll see you all again real soon.